From KCPW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Coming-of-age stories often highlight the normal adolescent fears of betrayal, concerns about safety, and the questions that come with an emerging identity. These worries are only magnified in Matthew J. Kirby's award-winning book, Icefall. Filled with Norse mythology, Kirby's tale follows three young Vikings whose father, the king, is off to war. They've been spirited away to a frozen refuge for their protection, but they soon suspect a traitor is among them. Today on the program, Matthew Kirby joins us to talk about mystery storytelling, his day job, and his big win at this year's Edgar Awards. Plus, celebrating Urban Creativity Week. A look at the Salt Lake City Urban Arts Festival. All that and your calls coming up after the news. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Matthew J. Kirby's Icefall, a coming-of-age tale filled with Norse mythology, garnered glowing reviews from Kirkus, Publishers Weekly, and the novelist Ursula Le Guin when it was published last year. But being nominated for and winning the coveted Edgar Award caught the Utah author completely by surprise. Today on the program, Matthew Kirby joins us to talk about the honor and how his day job fits in with his storytelling. Matthew Kirby joins me in studio. And Matthew, good morning. Thanks so much for your time.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Matthew Kirby is the author of two books. His first book is The Clockwork Three. His latest book, Icefall, is, as I mentioned, the winner of this year's Edgar Award for Juvenile Fiction. And he joins us in studio. Later on in the program, we're turning to urban arts, an arts festival with a decidedly urban feel. But first, Matthew Kirby, if you've got questions or comments about Icefall or mystery writing, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Matthew Kirby, last month you won the Edgar for juvenile fiction, and the Edgars, of course, are the most prestigious awards in the genre, mystery genre. Thank you so much for coming, and congratulations.
Thank you.
And we know that an Oscar, is heavy. It's gold. It's this figure. What does the Edgar look like, and what does it feel like?
The Edgar is a ceramic bust of Edgar Allan Poe.
Cool.
And it's honestly kind of an ugly little thing, but that's a part of its charm. It's been the same sort of trophy statuette since they started giving the award in 1946, when they still gave radio drama, awards. So it's kind of a tradition, and people kind of think that the unattractiveness is part of its appeal.
Describe the moment when you found out you'd been nominated. How did you react?
I was actually really surprised, because when I set out to write Icefall, it was first and foremost the main character Solveig's story. I think sometimes when you approach genre fiction, you have sort of the intent, I'm going to write a mystery, I'm going to write a fantasy. In this case, I wanted to write Solveig's story, and it happened to be a mystery. So the mystery was not first and foremost in my mind. I knew that was an important element. So to get the nomination for a mystery award did catch me off guard.
Where were you?
I was at work, and a fellow Utah writer, Tess Hilmo, actually emailed me and said, hey, did you see this? And I hadn't even seen it yet, so.
Speaking of work, you do have a day job. You are a school psychologist.
Yes.
And you work in the Davis School District. Are your two hats, the writer and the school psychologist, related in some way?
Well, there's obviously an overlap in who I'm working with. As a school psychologist, I am working with kids. For the past 7 years, I've worked with elementary age students, and that's also who I write for. So there is overlap in that the job as a school psychologist keeps me in daily contact with kids, and that does inform my writing in an indirect way. That daily contact, but I do have a very firm boundary, a line that I draw. Like, people assume that working as a school psychologist would provide me with this unending fountain of material, but I take the confidentiality and trust that I have with the students that I'm working with very seriously, and I would never want any of them to feel like they were recognizing themselves in one of my books and that I had somehow exploited that relationship.
I imagine that's a tenuous line, because people do identify with characters in books and
exactly.
they see parts of themselves.
Yeah.
And I did wonder if somebody, you know, if you've drawn certain character traits for your protagonist Solveig or for her sister Asa or other characters that appear in Icefall in your other book.
Not directly from any students that I know. Or children that I know. The characters in my books have all felt like individually distinct, real people to me. But, I mean, one thing about writing historical fiction is I think it makes it, it kind of creates a little bit more of that boundary.
You studied history as an undergraduate, and then you turned to educational psychology. Was writing ever part of this ambition, your equation, your life equation?
Writing has been an ambition since I was about 12 or 13. I started writing stories when I was in about third grade, and then when I was about 12 or 13, my parents gave me A Wizard of Earthsea for Christmas, and I had a moment as I was reading it where, and I mean, I can remember the specific sentence. It just struck me, and suddenly,
The sentence?
I've kind of got to set it up a bit. There's in the book A Wizard of Earthsea, the main character Ged is he's at a school learning how to do magic, and he's incredibly ambitious, incredibly brilliant, and kind of on a dare in conflict with other students at the school. He embarks on sort of a forbidden spell, and he brings this he opens this rift to another dimension, and he brings forth this creature that she described it as leaping through this rift as a clot of black shadow. And for some reason, those words, I suddenly became aware that behind every book there is an author who is crafting the story, the language, the words. And I reread it over and over and over again, that one line, and so it was then that I knew that I wanted to do what Ursula K. Le Guin was doing. I never, I guess, stopped to think about the fact that there are authors who are out there producing this work. And I knew I wanted to do that. So it has been an ambition from the very beginning. And that played a part in my choice to go into education, because I knew it would allow me summers and time to write.
We're speaking with the author Matthew J. Kirby. His book Icefall is the winner of this year's Edgar Award for Juvenile Fiction. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Let's turn to your novel, Icefall. It's set in Viking times. The king has three children. Their mother has died in childbirth, and he's off to battle. But he sent his children to this sort of secluded glacial environment to be protected by some of his prize warriors. When you wrote the book, you said you didn't think of it as a mystery. Now that you've won this mystery award, do you think of the book differently in any way?
I do. I mean, Icefall was always somewhat difficult to classify. I mean, I get emails from readers that they think it's a fantasy. Other people think it's a historical fiction. Other people think it's mystery. So it has sort of solidified or defined what it is a little bit for me, just in terms of how I describe it to people who haven't read it. But yeah, the mystery element of it is certainly central to the plot and how it moves forward.
Sure. How much research did you have to do in the Viking way of life or in Norse mythology as you embarked on this adventure?
Quite a bit. I really immersed myself in the literature of the time. There's the Poetic Edda and the Prose Edda, and they have, you know, the Norwegian sagas and Icelandic sagas. I really just immersed myself in those and just tried to put myself in that frame of mind, in that mindset from that time. It was just a very different way of looking at the world.
Can you elaborate on that a little bit? In what ways is the Viking worldview different from the way we think today?
Well, one thing that always struck me is that, the environment in a lot of ways, the environment back then is actively trying to kill you. In terms
it's
of
harsh.
Yeah, very, very harsh, a very harsh lifestyle. And so you can see why they would look at mountains and they would conjure trolls. I mean, because this is in some ways like those mountains are malevolent. The winter is malevolent. And every year it's all about preparing for that winter so that you have enough food to make it through, so that your livestock has enough food to make it through.
The protagonist in the book, Icefall, is a girl named Solveig. Describe this character for us.
Solveig actually was the first thing that came to me. The first few pages of Icefall remain in the book as I wrote them the first time through. Hmm. Her voice and her character were just there. And I actually put off writing the book. I wrote those first few pages and I became scared because I knew that I had to tell her story and do right by it, and I didn't know if I was up to that challenge. But yeah, she's just an amazingly complex character who in some ways is ahead of her time. She doesn't quite fit in with the people around her. She looks at things differently, but it's that different way of looking at things that ultimately proves, you know, her ability to save her family.
She's the middle child. She's got a beautiful older sister and sort of envies that physical beauty that she has. Her younger brother, the heir to the throne. So she's kind of in this precarious position in her family and her nation.
Yes, yes. She, in a lot, has never really felt like she belonged within her family. She's never felt that she has a role to play. Her sister, Asa, who is, you know, who's beautiful, is bringing suitors to her father and is going to create some kind of, you know, strategic relationship that way. Her brother is the heir apparent, and everyone just dotes on him, and she's always felt overlooked and ignored and doesn't really know what place she might play, but she desperately wants to do something important for her family and for her people.
Mm. Why did you decide to write in a girl's voice? And you know, and how hard was it to develop this female voice that was very authentic?
In some ways it was really easy, and then other ways it was difficult. I mean, I did have my editor at Scholastic, Lisa Sandell. I mean, she, as a woman, she was able to really kind of help me with some parts that definitely needed, you know, to be smoothed out. But in a lot of ways, that voice, like I said, from the beginning was really there. And I felt like I knew her, you know, from page one. But in terms of that choice, there didn't ever really seem to be another option for me, because when a character comes to you and basically is telling you, I tell my story, you have to do it first person. I mean, that was just really how it came about.
Mm. We're talking with Matthew J. Kirby. He's the author of the young adult novel Icefall, which won this year's Edgar Award for Juvenile Fiction. If you'd like to join us, if you have questions for Kirby about his writing or his day job as a school psychologist, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. We need to take a break, but we'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. By day, he's a respected school psychologist for the Davis School District, but his after-school activity as a writer is the reason we're talking with him today. We're speaking with Matthew J. Kirby, the Utah author and winner of this year's Edgar Award for Juvenile Fiction, for his book Icefall. And if you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number. If you have questions or comments about the book or about writing suspense novels for kids, give us a call, 801-355-8255. Before the break, we were talking about the primary character in Icefall, Solveig. I'd like to turn to some of the themes that you address. I mean, these are very common to the coming of age novel. But the primary one that stuck out for me in this book is the question of loyalty and the fear of betrayal. And I guess my question to you is, why pick that theme to be so prominent in the story of Solveig? I mean, in her life and in the way she handles relationships, and she's very conscious of her place in the world.
I think that came about at an almost unconscious level. As I kind of mentioned before the break, I immersed myself in the literature of the time, and loyalty is a very common theme in the Icelandic sagas and Norwegian sagas. And so as I was writing Icefall, I was trying to layer as much of that, as much as I had taken from that research, I was trying to layer that into the story. And so loyalty emerged as a theme, I think, through that kind of, influence.
Another one, of course, finding out how you are, who you are. And by the end of the novel, Solveig has kind of figured out where she belongs and who she is. Did this come for you in your teenage years as it did for Solveig, or did it come much later as you developed in your career and maturing as a writer?
It started at about the same age as it does for Solveig, and I think that's the case for, you know, a lot of kids. I mean, that sort of coming into your identity is a really universal theme, whether you're writing a young adult or middle grade novel set in ancient Norway, or you're writing a contemporary novel. I mean, that's just a part of maturation and that everybody goes through. I think in some ways that resonated with me, because it was at about 12 or 13 that I decided I wanted to be a storyteller. And Solveig also decides she wants to be a storyteller. The mode is different. I mean, in ancient Norse culture, I mean, you had skalds, who were these guys who would stand up before the hall and they would tell stories, and often compose them on the spot. And I compose at my computer and have plenty of time to edit. But the mode may be different, but that sort of finding the storyteller within at that particular age that Solveig, I guess Solveig and I do share that, yeah.
Mm. There is a great character in your book named Ulrik, I think.
Yep.
That's how you
yeah.
say it. And he is the storyteller. He's sort of like the entertainment for the people who are sequestered in this frozen fortress. Was having a storyteller part of that Viking tradition? I mean, did they bring storytellers along as a way to keep up morale and keep people's spirits high? Is that?
Yes. They were a big part of that culture. In fact, later on, after the time period in which Icefall takes place, there was actually a school for skalds in Iceland, run by Snorri Sturluson. And his writings and what he left behind, it's basically a playbook, a rule book for this is how you be a skald. And he established a lot of the rules for the skaldic verse, because it was very rigid, that form of art. But yeah, they were highly respected, and one of the most respected figures in that culture would be the ruler, the king or chieftain, who was also a skald and could also, you know, compose those epic stories.
And yet, at one point in the book, Ulrik says that Solveig should not trust him, because as storytellers, we're all liars.
Right. Yeah. Ulrik was a lot of fun to write, because he really he was in some ways my devil's advocate, because he was presenting a lot of questions and quandaries that stretch the limits of what a story is and what it isn't, and what a story can accomplish and what it can't. And so it was a lot of fun to play off those moments when he and Solveig are talking about what story is.
We're speaking with Matthew J. Kirby about his award-winning novel, Icefall. And if you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number. Why choose to write for the young adult audience? I mean, you've always known that you wanted to tell stories. You wanted to be a writer. But why young adults? Why children's lit?
You know, there was a moment a few years back. I've been actively trying to be published, writing, submitting for about well, I guess about 12 years now. It was about 10 years before I got my first book, you know, accepted by Scholastic. The first six or seven of those I did spend trying to write for adult audiences. But I had mild successes here and there, enough encouragement to keep going, but not nearly what I was hoping for. But one day I was just driving in the car and I realized that the ideas that I had, the stories that I wanted to tell, and because I work in schools, I read a lot of children's literature, and I realized that they're some of my favorite books to read. I thought maybe I'd be better suited writing for children. So I kind of threw out the project I'd been working on at that time, and I started working on a new book with the intent that I'm going to write this for a younger audience. And then I kind of started looking around, and it turns out here in Utah there's an amazing workshop run by Carol Lynch Williams. They're Writing and Illustrating for Young Readers Workshop. They hold it every summer. And I looked it up and found it, and I took a class from Martine Levitt there, and I met my agent at that conference, and things just sort of went. I mean, and things happened so well after that, it kind of confirmed to me that I'd made the right choice, that, yeah, this, the world of children's literature is where I should be kind of devoting my creative energy.
There are a number of best-selling and award-winning young adult novelists in Utah.
It is
quite amazing. Yeah. Brandon Mull, you know, the New York Times best-selling author, Rick Riordan, Sarah Zarr.
James Dashner.
Yeah, James Dashner. I mean, there are just many, many names that, I mean, what is it about Utah and kids' books? What do you think?
I don't know. That's actually a question that comes up all the time, and you hear many, many different possible answers, and I really don't know what it is. I wish I had some great answer for it. I'm just grateful for it because the community here is so amazing. I'm proud to be a part of it.
Your books, as you mentioned, are published by Scholastic, which is the world's largest publisher of children's books. I'm thinking Hunger Games, Goosebumps, Harry Potter. I mean, you don't get much bigger than those. You mentioned that you met your agent at a local function. How did you hook up with Scholastic?
Well, my agent took it from there. He had met the woman who would become my editor at a conference, and so he knew her tastes. He knew what she was looking for, and she was the first person that he sent the book to. And she responded immediately. Scholastic, they actually made an offer on the book 5 days after receiving the manuscript, which is,
wow,
it's incredibly fast. It really, really took me by surprise.
Well, you must have just thought, I've hit the jackpot getting signed with Scholastic.
Oh, it was the perfect place for me to land as an author. Mm. I've really, really been happy.
Let's go back to your experience at the Edgar Awards. On your blog, you mentioned that you had to buy a suit because
yes,
you didn't own one.
Yeah.
I find that
endearing. Well, it was black tie. I mean, I have blazers, but I didn't have an actual suit. And it had to be a black suit, too, because, I mean, half the people there were in tuxedos. But I didn't mind. I think hopefully I'll have other occasions to wear it.
What was that like, that moment right before your name was announced? I mean, it must have been just excruciatingly painful sitting there and waiting.
Well, honestly, it wasn't, because I had been so looking forward to meeting Neil Gaiman, who is another nominee for an Edgar in a different category, that I hadn't actually put a lot of thought into that actual moment when they would announce it. But it was kind of funny because I was actually able to sort of stay calm and not think about it until about 2 seconds before the presenter got up and read the nominees. And then my heart rate just skyrocketed. And then they said Icefall, and I walked up in a daze to give my speech.
So do you remember what you said?
Not really. I know that I quoted Richard Peck, the great children's author. He said that we write by the light of every book we've ever read. And I definitely feel that way about my writing, because there are so many authors who have inspired me over the years.
Speaking with Matthew J. Kirby, he's the author of Icefall, which won this year's Edgar Award for Juvenile Fiction. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Let's go to the phones, and Sam is joining us from Salt Lake City. Sam, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Hey, Matt, love your book. Icefall is a fabulous book. I just had a question for aspiring writers. You mentioned a little that you got an agent and all of that, but if someone is wanting to write a book and decides to go for it, what should he plan on doing or time expected so that one day he can be a published author?
Well, I would say that just in terms of realism, be prepared for a long haul. And if you really want to be published traditionally, that can take quite a while. The two biggest pieces of advice that I give to people, though, is to read as much as you can and as widely as you can. I usually make sure that I'm reading books in many different genres. Because story is universal, and I think as authors we need to see how it works, regardless of the setting or the characters. And then the other thing is to write as much as you possibly can, and don't be afraid to try new things and to just keep writing and keep writing different kinds of stories until you kind of find your voice. But yeah, be prepared for a long haul. I mean, I know that, you know, some of the newer ways of getting published that are not sort of the traditional, you go to a publisher and they publish it, like the self-publishing routes that are available now, have kind of shortened that process. But if you want to be published by one of the, you know, big New York publishers, be prepared for a long journey.
Sam, do you have a manuscript in your back pocket?
No, I don't. I hope to someday. That would be pretty cool. But I guess, so if in terms of the Utah community, is there, you mentioned a little bit about Martine Leavitt. Are there conferences that I should plan on going to, or anything that I should kind of become familiar with before I take all these steps?
Well, definitely get to know other writers and work with them. A critique group will be an invaluable resource to you. If you find a good group of people who are really willing to work with you and help you as you help them. That conference that I mentioned earlier, the Writing and Illustrating for Young Readers Workshop, it's actually coming up in the middle of June, and there are still slots available for a number of the classes. I'm actually teaching this year, so it's kind of a full circle moment. I got my start there, and I'm going back to teach there. But yeah, that, and you can go to their website, www.wifyr.com, and check that out.
I will put a link on our website, kcpw.org. Sam, thanks so much for the call.
Thank you.
801-355-TALK is our number. We're speaking with Matthew J. Kirby. He's the author of Icefall, which won this year's Edgar Award for young adult fiction. You mentioned that you were able to rub shoulders with one of your literary heroes, Neil Gaiman. What do you admire about Gaiman's work?
Well, with him, I actually, the reference in my speech to writing by the books, you know, by the light of the books we've read, that was a reference in that speech to Neil Gaiman being there in that room, because his novel, American Gods, which is an adult, you know, fantasy novel, it really was showed me how to layer mythology over a real concrete setting. And that was something I was looking to do with Solveig's story in Icefall. I wanted to work in the mythology and make it feel integral. And so American Gods was kind of a roadmap for me on how to do that.
Hmm. You've won an Edgar Award. This is a big deal. What is it going to mean for your writing career? I understand that you're sort of wrapping up one phase of your life as a school psychologist. You've decided to leave that profession and devote yourself to writing full time.
Yeah, and it's with a mix of emotions that I kind of take that leap. I love my job as a school psychologist, and I'm going to miss it. But it's really reached a point where I just don't have the bandwidth to do both. The time, you know, involved in writing in that career has just really become, it's become very demanding, and I feel very fortunate to be saying that. Mm. It has sort of reached a point where I feel like I was compromising both to try and do both. And so I want to commit to one and do it as well as I can.
Mm-hmm. Had you made that decision before the Edgar?
Actually, yeah, it was right before the Edgar. I'd kind of thought, you know, I think I've reached that point. I think it's time.
I understand you've got another book in the works. Can you tell us about this book project?
Yeah, well, I've got a couple in the works, actually. The book that I'm finishing up right now is a colonial American fantasy, kind of a Jules Verne-esque adventure through an American frontier that never existed. And that will be coming out next fall. Next fall, I will also have my installment in Scholastic's new Infinity Ring series. That's a really exciting project to be involved in. Just some amazing writers on that team, and we've had a lot of fun brainstorming and coming up with the story for that. And shortly, I hope to be able to announce plans for a fantasy trilogy with Scholastic after that.
You've got a few irons in the fire. I guess, finally, from you, what's the best thing about being a writer? I mean, is it the feedback you get from your fans? Is it just seeing your name in print for the first time? Is it telling these stories like Solveig's that you felt just had to be told? What is it?
Yeah, I think my favorite part is sharing these stories that I have I love these stories that I tell. I mean, they really, you know, excite my imagination, and to be able to put that out there and then hear back from kids that they enjoyed it, I mean, there's really nothing more rewarding.
Matthew J. Kirby, he is the author of Icefall, which won this year's Edgar Award for Juvenile Fiction, and soon to be an unemployed school psychologist. And Matt, thanks very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. It was fun.
Coming up after a break, celebrating graffiti, breakdancing, and skateboarding. This is City Views on KCPW, Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. Urban art, that includes graffiti, street performances, poetry slams, breakdancing. It's alive and well here in Utah, but it often doesn't get a broad public forum. Enter the Urban Arts Festival. Today on the program, we're going to learn more about urban arts and a new 33,000 square foot home for artistic growth. Joining me in studio is Derek Dyer. He is executive director of the Utah Arts Alliance. That's a nonprofit which promotes art in all forms. And he's also co-organizer of the second annual Urban Arts Festival. Derek, good morning. Thanks so much for your time.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Kat Palmer. She is a very recognizable photographer and a new tenant of the Arts Hub, which we'll be talking about. And Kat, good morning to you.
Good morning.
If you've got questions about urban art or Salt Lake City's new Arts Hub, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Derek Dyer, I want to start with you. Urban art forms. Define for us what it means, what that term means. What is urban art?
You know, for me, I think of it as any artistic expression that comes from the city, comes from different tools or techniques or inspirations that you would find in the city. So it's not necessarily just hip hop or anything like that, but for me, it's about making the most out of what you have. And in the city, it's a different environment than living in the suburbs or anywhere else. And so that's where we get a really unique artistic expression, I think. And that's where we get these really amazing urban artists, mural artists, things like that. A lot of really unique musical forms, and all of the different things that comes along with that, clothing makers, and then just the interesting style, the dance style that comes out of that, the whole, you know, like breakdancing battles, you know, instead of fighting to get you know, over on your competitors, dance it out, and that's how you resolve your conflicts and things like that. So I think there's a lot of really cool elements to urban style and urban expression. So,
Cap Palmer, what is it for you about living and working in the city that inspires you as an artist?
Oh, I love
as a photographer.
Salt Lake City is wonderful. The hustle and bustle, the beautiful city lights, the buildings, it's wonderful. And most of my art I shoot within the city with the urban landscape and the dilapidated brick. And right now I'm focusing on the Greenery District, and I've been shooting there a lot this week. And it's so beautiful. I've just discovered these amazing urban landscapes that I never knew existed, just exploring the city and taking my models out there. And I just love the city. So,
Derek, you say urban art is alive and well here in Utah. You don't think of urban art really necessarily and associate mm-hmm. that with Utah in the same sentence.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's, you know, we're known for our Red Rock. We're known for the beautiful mountains and skiing and kind of outdoors kind of activities.
Mm-hmm.
But you say there is a very vibrant urban art scene here.
Yeah, I agree that you might not think of Utah as being big on the urban art scene, but Salt Lake City is sort of the oasis and anomaly within the state where there's amazing art scene. I mean, one of the top art scenes in the country. We're kind of like Austin, you know. Austin is an oasis in Texas of artistic expression and festivals and really colorful, vivid art scenes and things like that. So. I think if you're not familiar with Salt Lake, you might be surprised by that, but we see it all the time. I mean, just at the Arts Hub itself, we have the B-Boy Federation, which is a really popular and active breakdancing organization. They have monthly battles that probably draw 300 dancers.
Mm.
And it's just really amazing to watch their their annual competition. I don't even know, probably over 1,000. So,
it's out there.
Yeah, yeah. And if you just drive around Salt Lake City, you'll see some amazing murals. More and more are going up all the time. Many of them are sanctioned in part by the city, you know. So I think more and more people are starting to appreciate these different art forms and expressions in the city.
Speaking with Derek Dyer, Executive Director of the Utah Arts Alliance, also co-organizer of the Urban Arts Festival, which is being held next Saturday, June 9th, from 11 to 8 p.m. at the Salt Lake City Arts Hub in Salt Lake City. There's more detail on our website, kcpw.org. But if you have questions or comments about urban art, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. I mentioned that the Urban Arts Festival will be held at the Arts Hub, which recently opened in Salt Lake City. Derek, what's the idea behind the Arts Hub?
Well, the Arts Hub is it's sort of a combination of a lot of things. You have artist studio spaces, you have performance space, dance studios, office space for nonprofits, a couple art galleries, workshop areas, a circus tent.
Nice.
A large property to have festivals and things like that on. So that's the short answer of it. The longer answer would be that it's really a place for a community of artists and art appreciators, art lovers to come together and connect with each other. There's a lot of different like studio spaces that you can, you know, maybe rent, or just office spaces that you can rent. But this is a little bit of a different nonprofit business model, if you will. What we really want to do is have a balance of the arts. So we have visual artists, we have performing artists, we have dance artists. We have places for them all to be able to not only work, do business and practice, but also perform and invite the public to come see them perform. So it's really a home for artists in all forms and all mediums, which goes back to our mission, is fostering the arts in all forms. And
Cap Palmer, you know, you're an accomplished photographer. Your studio is now at the Arts Hub, so you're a tenant. What drew you to move your work to this sort of creative environment?
Well, I heard about it in November, and the second you walk in, you just realize what a cool space it is. And we
What makes it cool, though?
Oh, gall. There's just such a good flow to it. Right now, the energy there, there's always movement, there's performances always going on, there's other artists that you can talk with. I mean, it's such a great feeling when you're there at the space. I love being there. And anyone that visits feels that immediately, and they talk about the energy and how cool it feels there. And so we hopped in immediately. I wanted dibs on offices before they were all taken, because I knew as soon as word got out, it would be full. Mm-hmm. And so we were able to pick a really, really great space. We picked 4 rooms, and we were able to remove a couple walls and make our space bigger. And I don't know, it's just everyone that comes to our space loves it, and they don't want to leave. And so we're just so thankful that we got in before it filled up, because I think there's only 3 available spaces left there now. It's uh-huh. full almost. And so we love it there. It's just, it's great. And not only that, but as an artist, I feel more professional. You know, I do this full time for a living, and I have a studio now that I can just focus on shooting in. They have a space there just for photographers, so I don't have to shoot where I make my art. I have a totally separate space for that. And I've got a conference room that I can utilize, and so I meet with my clients there, and I just feel more professional as an artist and in this space. And so
has the creative vibe there, the energy as you describe it, has that influenced your the way you're approaching your work now in the last few months? Have you noticed that at all?
Yeah, I think it is, because there's just so many artists there to bounce ideas off of and to talk about projects with, and there's just always somebody there. You know, it's such a community of artists and dancers, and it's wonderful. And so we talk about our projects that are coming up, and we really do bounce ideas off of each other of, you know, things that we're working on, things we're doing, and mm-hmm. so...
Speaking with Kat Palmer, the photographer, also Derek Dyer, the executive director of the Utah Arts Alliance. We're talking about the new arts hub downtown, as well as the upcoming Urban Arts Festival. Give us a call if you have questions or comments. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. 33,000 square feet, though, Derek. I mean, this is a huge undertaking. How did you finance it?
With a lot of creativity. One thing about being an artist before I became a businessman taught me how to make things out of nothing. And so that's I guess one way to put it. The Utah Arts Alliance has been around for almost 10 years. Mm-hmm. And so we've been doing this for a little bit, and so we know what we're doing. We recently had to move out of a space that we've been in for 9 years, and at the same time we were considering moving our gray wall gallery from Pierpont Avenue. So the timing was just kind of good. Fortunately, Salt Lake City Redevelopment Agency was able to work with us on getting this property and getting the buildings, and they've been amazing to work with.
Did you have major renovation to do?
We have done some pretty large renovation. We've installed it's about a 5,000 square foot dance studio. So that included taking out the carpet, walls, raising the ceiling up, and then installing a huge dance floor. Mm-hmm. You know, and so that was one of the big projects. Another project was the gallery, which is about a 3,000 square foot gallery space, which is huge in Salt Lake City. You know, that's been a major project, redoing the ceilings, redoing the floor. The two big projects we're working on now are finishing up our circus tent, which we put up, and we're just waiting to get the final permits and everything in place to be able to use that for the rest of the season for events and things like that. It's really fun. And then we have another building on the property that's called the Cube. And so it's the Cube at the Hub. And the Cube is going to be the performance space. So we're going to introduce a new black box theater type of venue to Salt Lake City. And we already have several plays and performances scheduled in there for later in the fall.
Speaking with Derek Dyer about the Urban Arts Festival and the new Arts Hub, which is at 633 West 1st South in Salt Lake City. And Kat Palmer is with us, the photographer. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number. Let's go to the phones. Pete is joining us from Salt Lake City. Pete, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, thanks.
Great. I've been following the kind of the evolution of the Arts Hub and have been really impressed with the list of partners that the UAA has, especially their as it relates to their emphasis on cultural diversity and promoting and providing service for underserved and economically disadvantaged people. I'm really curious if your guests could comment a little bit on that.
Okay, Pete, interesting question. Thanks for the call. Derek Dyer, diversity and how it fits into the mission of the Arts Hub.
Well, diversity has always been very important to me and the Utah Arts Alliance. We have an amazingly diverse group. To name some of the groups, just to give people an understanding of the types of different groups that are in there, we have Salt Lake Capoeira, one of our major partners. They're a Brazilian cultural organization, as well as Samba Fogo. We have People Productions, which is an African-American theater company. We have Human Rights Education Center, which deals with all sorts of diversity issues. We have Rhythms of Life that does a lot of educational programming in schools.
The Drum Circle.
The Drum Circle?
Yeah, we have the Drum Guys.
What is that, Kat?
Derek?
Well, we actually have several drumming classes. We have a West African drummer, Quinn. And he's one of the world's top drummers, and he just got back from India doing some educational stuff there.
And we have the Drum Bus, which is very cool.
Mm-hmm, the Drum Bus.
What is that?
It's just basically he goes around and teaches his drumming to children.
Oh, the Drum Boss.
Bus. Mm-hmm. He has a bus. He has a couple beautiful buses where he takes them and teaches children and does these events for people and for children, and I just think it's mm-hmm. a great thing that he does. Mm-hmm. So.
We have a lot of youth programming, too. Kat is also starting a new program through the Arts Alliance. I'll let her talk about that. But we have we do a lot of programmings, like the caller said, that especially target underserved, at-risk youth, and through visual arts, music, dance, things like that. So. Mm-hmm.
Kat, tell us about this new youth program.
Yeah, it's a baby of mine and Michael Christensen's. We've been working on a youth arts program, and I saw a need for there to be arts being taught to the youth without the youth having to pay for it, because I just think, you know, if parents have a choice between paying their bills and, you know, sending their kids to extracurricular art classes, they're going to choose paying their bills. And so we've teamed up with several high schools within the area, and we'll be teaching it there at the Hub. We have teachers that are lined up. It's going to start this fall, and it's for kids ages 12 to 18. And we recently did not get the grants that we were hoping for, so we're now reaching out to have private funding and sponsorships for this program. So,
it sounds like there's a lot that you have on your docket. How do you see the Arts Hub sort of fitting in to the larger art scene here in Utah, because there are a lot of artists here? How does this kind of fit into the big picture?
Well, I think we're just a small piece of the larger picture of, you know, Salt Lake City art scene. We have an amazing scene here with Art Space, all the many different amazing galleries, and the other artist studio spaces. I think we complement the rest of the art scene really well. I think we're building onto it. I think we're probably, I feel like from what I've gathered from people, we're changing the landscape a little bit of the art scene in Salt Lake. This is such a major project, and being right downtown Salt Lake City, it's a major development for the art scene, and which is really a benefit to all of the artists, whether they take part in the Arts Hub or not. It's a benefit to them to just be able to have more opportunity, more space, and just more art in the city.
We've only got about a minute left, but this is just the second annual Urban Arts Festival. The Arts Hub just opened last month. Mm-hmm. Where do you see this going? You know, 5 years down the road, where do you see the Arts Hub and the Urban Arts Festival sort of developing?
Okay. Well, our goal from day one, 10 years ago, when we founded the Utah Arts Alliance, was to have an Arts Hub similar type of center throughout the state. And so eventually we'd like to, our next goal in the next couple of years is to possibly do an Arts Hub St. George. So that's kind of the idea with that. I think we would also like to open a second location in downtown Salt Lake City. We have a gallery and recording studio on Main Street that we may need to move out of with the theater project coming up, and we'd like to relocate that into a bigger facility. I foresee the Urban Arts Festival becoming, in the next 5 years, one of the biggest festivals we have in Salt Lake.
That's Derek Dyer. You heard it here first. He's executive director of the Utah Arts Alliance and co-organizer of the Urban Arts Festival, which will be held next Saturday, June 9th, from 11 a.m. to 8 p.m. at the Salt Lake City Arts Hub. And there's more information on our website, kcpw.org. Derek Dyer, Kat Palmer, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you so much.
City Views is a production of KCPW in Salt Lake City. Thanks to Lauren Hendrickson. Our technical director is Jesse Ellis. Coming up tomorrow, it's Politics Up Close. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce.